after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to 91 FM. Well, with me now is Antazaki Shangai, poet, playwright, and novelist, who's best known for her choreo poem for colored girls who have considered suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough. This piece got its start in a Berkeley women's bar, was then produced by Joseph Papp, off, then on Broadway, and earlier this year was adapted for public television. Her first novel has just been published. It's called Sassafras, Cypress, and Indigo. These are the names of three sisters, whose mother is a weaver who gave her daughters the names of vivid dyes. Sassafras, the oldest, wants to be a writer, but is constantly frustrated by her inability to write. She weaves instead. She falls in love with a saxophonist who sometimes treats her well and sometimes mistreats her, but even when he does, she's unable to stay away from him. Cypress is a dancer who tries to get her black body to conform to the standards of a traditional white ballet until she becomes a peripheral part of a lesbian dance scene. Indigo, the youngest, learns magic and learns to use spells and potions and makes music on her violin. The three women are, in a way, three answers to the question, what experiences are shaping the lives of modern black women? Their mother is a Christian who wants her children to marry and have children and live in a nice middle-class home, but she realizes that's not exactly what her children want for themselves, and she remains devoted to them. This novel is published by the St. Martin's Press. The novel's prose is woven with poems, spells, potions, and recipes. And Sasaki Shange's other plays include Spell No. 7 and Boogie Woogie Landscape. She lives in New York, and she has a baby daughter. And Sasaki Shange, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to see you.
Oh, thank you. It's good to see you again.
This is your first novel. You've written a lot of poems. You've written several plays.
And a lot of short stories.
Did you know that it was time to write a novel?
No, this is the problem of being a public person. In other words, if you don't offer the public everything all at once, they assume you aren't doing anything or you're only doing what is available to them. I started Sassafras in 1974. I have been writing prose since 1971. It is not my big commercial vehicle, but it's something that I've been committed to as a craftsman for a long time. And I, in fact, had parts of Sassafras finished long before I had For Colored Girls finished, because For Colored Girls was, in fact, Cypress's diary. And so it just ruined my book when the choreo poem took on a life of its own, which was very good. I mean, I'm not unhappy about it, but it meant that the novel had to gestate some more because I had to build a whole new unconscious for this child. And I thought I had done it, and apparently I did, but the unconscious got up and walked away.
Do you think that each of the sisters in your novel, and it is about three sisters, are three kind of answers to the question, what is shaping them?
They're not so much answers as they are options. I wanted to explore in a more significant way than you can with poems, because poems are so short and instantaneous and emotional, and they also have no territory. I wanted to explore a woman's territories. What choices can you make? What things can you go discover on your own? What are the pitfalls of these things? Are there swamps out there? Is there quicksand out there? Is there a lilac patch? I mean, what can we come across as sort of freewheeling, thinking, creative females who live in the northern part of the Americas?
I'd like to talk about the women that you've created for your novel. And why don't we talk a little bit about each of them? And what I'd like to ask you to do is to read a section about each of them from your new novel before we talk.
Oh, surely. That's no problem at all. I like them. As a matter of fact, I'm devoted to them.
The first character we meet in the novel is Indigo, so maybe that would be a good place to start. If you'd like to give us an overall introduction to the book.
I wasn't going to do the overall so much as that I was going to explain what we're going to meet about Indigo right now. Indigo is the only one we know as a child, and I wanted to do that because I really didn't want to spend a lot of time on Sassafras and Cypress's childhoods, because I wasn't very interested in them. I was interested in them as adults, but I wanted to know what it would be like to be a little girl who had these two older fantastic and whimsical and adventurous sister. So I put her in the beginning of the book as an introduction to the two other ones, because I think as an oldest daughter, I know that it is unfair to view the family from the oldest daughter's perspective, because she was not there for so much of it. And it's the littlest one who knows more about the processes of the entire family growth than any of the other children would know. So we start with Indigo, and she is She is now with this woman who's a good friend of hers, named Sister Mary Louise. And Sister Mary Louise is, we wouldn't call her a born-again Christian. She is what they called a good Christian sister. And she is devoted to the church, and she has been known to get the spirit in the street. She just prays all the time, and she can probably do laying on of hands and heal and all kinds of things of that nature. And she's fervent believer in the powers of the Lord Jesus Christ. But she's also a little whimsical in the sense that it's also been said about Sister Mary Louise that she has flights of fancy with young men from the Georgia Sea Islands on occasion, and which sort of lets people laugh at her a little bit because she's very Christian, but she gets carried away by a good-looking young man. I would imagine that Sister Mary Louise is about, maybe 38, 40. She was having Indigo over to her house to help her bake some bread. And Indigo was getting one of her good Christian lessons about the Bible and the good way to live and what the Lord will do for you if you do right. Indigo is annoyed because Sister Mary Louise doesn't believe in talking to dolls and haunts and loud music and the ways of the world, the things of temptation and the devil. So Indigo's been complaining all this time about what she can't do. If she goes off with Jesus, what can she do? There's nothing for her to do. And so we're going to start in the middle of that scene. I already told you, you're too big to be talking to dolls. Good Lord, Indigo, look at yourself. Indigo tried to focus on Sister Mary's face, but she only saw a glimmering. She tried to look at herself and kept blinking her eyes, rubbing her palms over them to get some focus. She saw something springing out of her in a large scarlet pool at her feet. Sister Mary jumped up and down. Indigo, the Lord's called you to be a woman. Look on high for his blessing. Look, I say, look to Jesus who has blessed you this day. Indigo fell down on her knees like Sister Mary had and listened and swayed in her growing scarlet lake to the voice of this green-eyed woman singing for the heavens, trouble in mind, unmade my vow, and rise and shine, so the Indigo would know among whom was Mary Magdalene. Speak, child, raise your voice that the Lord may know you are the woman you are. Then Sister Mary Louise rose, her thin body coated with Indigo's blood. She gently took off Indigo's clothes and dropped them in a pail of cold water. She bathed Indigo in a hot tub filled with rose petals, white, red, and yellow, floating around a new woman. She made Indigo a garland of flowers and motioned for her to go into the backyard. There in the garden among God's other beauties, you should spend these first hours. Eve's curse threw us out the garden, but like I told you, women tend to beauty and children, and now you can do both. Take your blessing and let your blood flow among the roses. Squat like you will when you give birth. Smile like you will when God chooses to give you a woman's pleasure. Go now, like I say, be not afraid of your nakedness. Then Sister Mary shut the back door. Indigo sat bleeding among the roses, fragrant and filled with grace.
Indigo learns magic and, mm-hmm. and spells and potions. And I wonder if that comes from an interest you have in magic.
I have an interest in the incredible ingenuity of my people. I have a great respect and fascination for the ways in which we have managed to survive some very obvious and terrible traumas, and some more subtle and invidious traumas. And I know that through our closeness to the land, before we had the great migrations north, that there was a lot that we did for one another and for ourselves that had to do with our familiarity with growing things, and also a trust in the land itself.
Have you studied magic in any way?
I had to study some, because I had to study some some herbal healing in order to be able to give this character the kinds of powers I needed her to have. So in that sense, yes. I also used to frequent bembés with santeros. A long time ago, for a very long while, I did that. So I was in the company of padrinas and madrinas who were sometimes offering me things to do for myself so I could use that information, too.
The kind of magic that she does is a very female magic, mm-hmm. having to do sometimes with menstrual blood mm-hmm. and with other rituals pertaining to women. Do you think that there is a female magic?
Well, I think that was one of the things I wanted to do with Indigo. I wanted to give the literature, women's literature and black literature, a persona who was not out of touch with the 20th century, and who still could maintain primal and immediate contact with natural forces in such a way that it seemed to be supernatural, but I don't believe they are. I think they are simply the parts of us that have been congealed and repressed by the patriarchy and by all kinds of perverse economic situations and misogyny.
The mother of the three daughters mm-hmm. in your book is a good Christian woman.
Oh, yes, she certainly is.
Who thinks that this is definitely the beginnings of paganism.
Right.
She does not approve. Do you see that kind of conflict happening in some families now?
Oh, I don't know if it happens. I'm sure it happens now if you have a good Christian mother and you decide that you want to go around the corner and see Aunt Bessie, who's going to give you some asafoetida to put around your neck to keep off the evil eye. I think when children are always impressed with ritual, and they're impressed with the possible properties of anything that they have never seen before. And there's reason to be. I think that is an honest, justifiable response to being on the planet where you don't know everything and what everything can do. But when you have made an order of the planet through the eyes of the Lord, then certain things become good and certain are not so good. So I think that it's part of a tension that has always existed. It exists in the culture between church music and blues music, between, say, the politics of Marcus Garvey and the politics of Du Bois. It makes itself manifest in different ways. Some things get a little too colored, and then at a certain point, somebody in your family will say, that's enough, we can't go back there, meaning we can't go back to the roots of slavery. And I think that's what we have to do in order to stay ourselves and to stay alive as a culture. We have to continually go back to the roots of slavery. We can never let it get too far away.
Do you see any connections between the kind of magic that you've given to your character Indigo and the kind of magic that some women are practicing?
Wiccas, you mean?
Witches. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's I think, for the most part, kind of West Coast,
it's a real
lesbian
West Coast,
feminist,
well, yeah, it's a real lesbian
goddess
feminist
worship
activity, with whom I have a great deal in common. I really believe that all women are in possession of these powers, and I believe that we have not made use of them for a number of years. And however we revive it in whatever way is good. I also think that we should remember that all women have them, so that a lot of women don't want to go to Wiccas because they think they're only going to be able to be around lesbian witches. So that's ridiculous. All women can, in fact, become powers of the natural forces. We do not have our sexual preference has nothing to do with that. And that was one of the things that I wanted to point out in the book, too. That's why I gave it to a child as opposed to giving it to, I could have given them to Sassafras and Cypress, who have different kinds of powers. But I didn't want to do that because I wanted to make it available to everybody. All of us can have it. And there are some things I take and give to certain women. Certain women have this. I give them different things. I tried to be, you know, not, I tried not to have preferences for any one kind of woman, because I want all of us to feel that there is nothing wrong with us, and so we can be however we want. And I try to get the people in the book to behave that way. And when they don't behave that way, I try to let them have conversations that reveal to us that they are being petty and simple-minded. They're definitely related.
There's one other thing I want to ask you about the magic, then we'll move on mm-hmm. to Sassafras, another of the sisters in your book. It's funny, I've felt in a way that some of the things that women have been reacting against is this notion that women are this, and mm-hmm. women are nurturing and mm-hmm. giving and receptive mm-hmm. and, you know, mm-hmm. more spiritual mm-hmm. and all of this. And it's things that have been defined
right.
for women mm-hmm. and not by
yeah.
women.
Oh,
and
yeah.
and I wonder if this isn't in some ways the kind of new magic and the new witchcraft doing the same thing, except women doing it to each other instead of it being perpetrated on
well,
them.
Well, defining oneself is the responsibility of a human being. So we have to, as long as we're defining it, and as long as it was not a gift that somebody else gave us, and it's ours, it is a power, it is something we are in control of, to do with as we please, that makes it totally different. It's the difference between somebody standing with a gun over you, telling you what you are and who you are and what you can and cannot do, and having your own rifle and telling them what you are in fact going to do. We do not, in fact, necessarily have to have rifles. We are, I think, moving faster than the speed of light. We are lasers. We can do all kinds of things.
And Zaki Shange is my guest, if you're just joining us. And we're talking about her new book, Sassafras, Cypress, and Indigo, which is her first novel. And we're talking about the three sisters that she's created for the novel. Let's move on to the next sister, which is the oldest.
The oldest one, Sassafras.
Would you do a reading of one of her passages from your novel?
I think this is a small passage, but I think it really helps me with her because she is difficult in the sense that she's not as articulate as the others are. And she's also not as what I would call advanced in terms of her consciousness. So it's more difficult. It's more inchoate in a way. It's very ritualized and she's stable, but there's still something under there that's just not worked out yet. When she moved, she went to her looms. Making cloth, being a woman and longing to be of the earth, a rooted blue, some ripe berries happening inside, spirits walking in a dirt road, toes dusted and free, faces moving windy, brisk like dawn, round gingham windows and opened eyes reeling to days ready-made in nature's image. I am rejoicing with a throat-deep shout and slow, like a river gathering space. That's how she feels to me in her more calm moments. She is for me. I don't know. She's my primitive person. She has not yet made a commitment to herself. She has made a commitment to. She's more like mommy, her mother, in the sense that she has made a commitment to her family, to her household, to her daily tasks. She knows how to do all of those things, but her commitment to herself, she has not made yet. That's why she can't write anything. That's why she continually has visits from women who are dead. Who made terrible errors. And the women who visit her, it's very funny, are all women who made the choice not to make commitments to what it is she's made commitments to. So that in her fantasy life, she's dealing with all these women who are out in the street singing blues in nightclubs, dancing in the Cotton Club chorus line. And here she is at home making hats for this dope addict she lives with. And I think that some of the reasons that she chose these women who were not only dead but who had very difficult lives was because it kept saying to her that she was doing the right thing, even though when she had the fantasies, they all told her that she should get up out of the house and go do something. So she's sort of, she's my primitive person, my unrealized one.
Was it hard for you to keep her in this really destructive relationship?
It was ridiculous. I really didn't want to do it, but I knew that she wouldn't leave. I kept trying to figure out how could I get her away from this house, and I realized that I wouldn't be able to do it because she wouldn't ever really stay away, because she wasn't willing to take on the world by herself. Even though, in fact, she had already taken on the world by herself, because whether you live with a man or not, you're still in the world by yourself. But she had this illusion that she wasn't, so she kept going back. And I figured the only thing, since she had made this commitment to this family stuff, I knew that about her. I knew the only way she would get away from him is if I gave her a baby and he was a threat. If he was a threat to the life of somebody she was responsible for, she would leave, and that's what happened.
There's a very interesting contradiction in the passages about her. Early on when we meet her, she's a block writer and is weaving instead, and she makes a kind of wall hanging in a vaginal shape that her lover tells her to put away because it's not really proper for a new African woman to be making such sexual objects.
Right.
But then later on, he has some of his men friends over, and they're reading a poem called Ebony, and I can't say the next word
on the air,
but it's a vernacular word for a woman's genitals. And it's a poem that she finds incredibly insulting. She leaves the room, and it's like okay for them. They think it's really hip to be reading this poem. What does that juxtaposition mean to you?
Well, I was trying to get at something that happened early in the 70s and the late 60s, which was during the Black Nationalist period. All these young men were going around, as they say, sowing oats and they were sowing oats with other Black nationalist females, but we were not supposed to enjoy it. We were not supposed to demand it. We were not supposed to have any particular things we wanted to do. We were not supposed to be doing this with more than one person. They were having great espousings of polygamy and all kinds of strange things. And I was trying to get at this ridiculous double standard that when you're doing something that only mating people can do, that only one of the mates was supposed to be having a good time, and only one of the mates was supposed to realize that this was genuinely something that all human beings share. And so that was the contradiction there for me. It was a contradiction that we lived with for a long time until a lot of women began to realize that we were being robbed of our own sensual possibilities. And I think it's sort of dying out. At least I hope so.
Later on, she and her lover become part of a new African community.
Right.
And I wonder what kind of community you've based this fictional community.
Well, I know that there were a lot of communitarian settlements in the same period, in the late 60s, early 70s, of people trying to create new utopias, or at least alternative lifestyles in a collective manner. Some were religious-based communes, some were politically based, some were just artist communes with no particular philosophy other than we will not have personal property and we will raise our children together. I knew that a lot of people in the United States did not realize that Black people also were optimistic and also had utopian dreams. And so, and I knew a whole lot of them, and I had even thought about trying to do that myself. And I designed one time. I figured out what I wanted mine to look like. In about, I think, 71, I spent the whole summer designing this community and how was it going to survive and who was going to be in it and what were the educationals. It's like building a whole world. And so I decided that one of these girls should, in fact, take that as an option. Because this book is all about options for women. So that was one of the options. If you can't deal with sexism and racism, leave and go make a new world. And that's what they went. They went to the New World collectives where they lived. And I based that on information I had about some Black experimental communities. That we know the Republic of New Africa had one. We know that some people who practiced Santeria from New York went and left and went to Georgia. We know that there were a couple of Black ones in North Carolina too, and there was one in Vermont that was Black people. There were a lot of Black people who went singly to racially mixed communes, but these that I just mentioned were specifically Black ones, and they were farmers for the most part, and craftsmen who they made jewelry a lot, and cloth, and pots, and things like that.
Will the community you created for your book have lasted?
I think the older people could have stayed. I don't think the younger people could have stayed, and I don't think that the educational system would have been able. The children wouldn't have received the kind of education they deserved. The one thing that was nice about this community, as opposed to, for instance, the kind of stress the Republic of New Africa had to live under, was that it was not political in the sense that the FBI was looking for them all the time or that they were trying to undo it, because it was essentially a religious community. And in that sense, that it was more secure than the Republic of New Africa. I had thought about modeling it after that, but then I decided that I was not going to have white policemen come kill any of my characters, so I just got rid of that idea.
Why not?
Because I'm not going to kill Black people in my story. That's why. I'm not killing them. I'm trying to make a book where people live and make a land where people can stay alive. So I only refer to people who had died before the book started. You know, but not in the story itself, because we know enough about death and dying.
And Zaki Shange is my guest, if you're just joining us, and we're talking about her new novel, just published by St. Martin's Press, and it's called Sassafras, Cypress, and Indigo. And these are the names of three sisters in her book, and we're looking at each of the characters and what some of the aspects of their lives were. Let's turn to Cypress now, who's the third sister. Would you read a passage from your book about
this
her?
Is Cypress's journal number 48. She is in New York now. She's just gotten there from California, and she's having culture shock, as all Californians do when they come to New York or go east at all. So she's having that stress. Plus, she is working with a dance company when she's the only female, and all the men in the company are gay, and they're trying to be at this point, because they know she's outnumbered, they're getting very, very touchy about whether if she is female enough, because as the only female, she has to represent the entire part of the species, and they are doing, in some cases, a better job than her, and she's just had it. She has had it. The guy in a dance class asked for women to come get to go across the floor, and all these guys came went across the floor with her, and she had had it. She said, okay, look, I don't mind what you're doing with each other, but you are not women. You are men. And this was not clear. So in journal entry number 48, she's writing, everybody I know has lost their mind. Sometimes I wish I was crazy, too. Then I could get some sleep. This way I keep looking around, waiting for X to jump, trying to catch Y before he picks up another one-night stand for the second time, imagining Z cutting his wrists, A, B, C, and D running naked on 42nd Street. Everybody I know is recovering from a bad affair, wishing for Mr. Right, looking for Miss True, and I can't get any rest. I am so tired and nerve-worn. When the antelopes and gazelles peeped through my window, I invited them in. The conversations I was having weren't important enough to exclude animals of note. I bit my tongue for mentioning Jean Harlow to Freddie Washington. My friends are ridiculous. I have to change my associations. Talk about fantasy running wild. Please don't anybody say, and this is your life. So that was a major turning point for her. After that, she went to join Azure Bosom, who were the lesbian dance company, modern dance company, who worked at this place called Ovary Studio. And then she fell in love with Adrina, and it goes from there.
Are there any messages about gay men that you're trying to get across?
No. Cyprus is not necessarily a well-balanced person. I was getting at that she was in a situation where she was not getting any nourishment. That was not their fault. That was her fault. She had to do something. She made a decision to go do something about herself. Whatever the motivations for it were, that's all it took. She saw other people being loved and getting love, and she was not getting any. I think it was more a reaction of either envy or resentment or something, because they were a community in and unto themselves, and they were taking care of each other. And she was not part of that. And that was what I was getting at.
When she's introduced in the novel, mm-hmm. and is learning how to dance, she's really trying to be a traditional mm-hmm. ballet dancer,
right.
and her body doesn't quite fit into the mold. Her tush is a little too big, and she's always dieting and exercising to mm-hmm. try to get it. I think it's when she joins the lesbian dance group that those kinds of norms fade away, and that new questions begin mm-hmm. to be asked.
Well, those kind of norms had faded when she was in the Kushites Returned, but see, that was still a male-centered dance company. And it was also a traditional African dance for the most part, which is awfully male. The males get all the big jumps. They get to do cartwheels. They get to do all the high drama turns. And so that she still was in some way inhibited in terms of really making manifest her art. And it's in the Azure Bosom Dance Company that what is female becomes what is exalted. And therefore, and also, what is female is unknown. So there is no traditional female dance. They're making them up. They are exploring what is abstract and cosmological about us as women. And so that, for her, is intellectually stimulating as well as giving her a new basis for a creative aesthetic that she had been looking for and didn't know what it was. So they, I think, are instrumental in terms of her development.
But you haven't created for her a paradise in this mm-hmm. lesbian group. There's a lot of destructive as well as constructive forces.
Well, the other thing about this, I had a whole bunch of, I've taught women's studies for a long time, and I would have these arguments with my students who were telling me all the time that heterosexuality was the pits and you should never see men because they're the oppressor and this, that, and the other. And I said, fine, look, women are also human beings, and if you think you're going to find paradise with any other human being, you're out of luck. There is this great mythology, especially with young, newly converted feminists, that lesbian separatism is, in fact, heaven because we are all women and therefore we would never hurt each other. That is not true. We have as much growing to do as any other person who's born has to do. And some of us do it well and some of us don't. Some of us are stingy. Some of us are not. Some of us are fly-by-nights. Some of us are not. Some of us can make commitments. Others of us cannot. Some of us are two-timing people. I mean, there's all kinds of things that women do And I wanted to make sure that that was in here somewhere, because I'm not trying to, I'm not creating new virgins. I am not interested in the kind of trap that you find in making any one kind of woman more precious than any other.
You move her out of this crowd, and she falls in love with a jazz musician who's, in a way, the opposite of the jazz musician that Sazerac has fallen in love with. He's independently wealthy. He's also
he's
an
really
excellent
funny,
musician.
Right.
Yeah, and he's kind of really reliable, good person who wouldn't mistreat someone.
Right. That's what I wanted to do that too. I wanted. It's not necessary to be with a male person. It's not necessary to be with a female person. Either of those things are nice if you choose to do it. And there are some male people who are not nice. That was what Mitch was. There are some who are just not worth the time of day. But then there are other ones like Leroy McCulloch who are really sort of delectable. And you'd say like, oh, goodness, I'd love to go out with him or something and or get to know him or something like that. And I wanted one of them to be there. And I also wanted to make sure that we dealt with the fact that all Black artists are not, we all didn't come up from the street. In other words, some of us studied for a long time to have all kinds of technical virtuosity. Some of us were orphans. Some of us, in fact, got sent away to school because we couldn't stay home because of family problems. Others of us won scholarships to places. I wanted to make sure that somebody like that was around, because otherwise, if we just look at what we get to see usually about the Black people, our world gets too little. So I was trying to make sure that the world didn't get too little for the girls, because I want them to have a larger arena than we've been allowed before.
The fourth main character of women in the family that you're writing about is the mother. Could you read one of her letters as an introduction to her?
Let me find one for you. I think there's one. I know here's one. Oh, no, I don't want to read that one. I know there's one to Indigo, when Indigo's just left to go on to visit her on Haiti and the islands and the Fusky. Indigo eventually goes to live with her Aunt Haiti, who's a very strange woman who's a midwife who lives on the islands and works with Geechies and just stays out there. The family is from the Georgia Sea Islands, in fact, and they've just moved to Charleston, I guess, in the last generation or so. My littlest angel, Indigo, I've been making preserves to send to my girls, some canned tomatoes and pickles, too. You know, I have to stay busy, even though the Lord knows I'd be a mighty big somebody if I ever ate all that I sat up cooking. Meanwhile, I miss you all so much. There's times in a mother's life that are simply trying times. I've prayed and thought a whole lot about my life and yours. Now, wouldn't I look simple, keeping a house full of grown women aching to be part of the world from being a part of the world just so I wouldn't be quite so lonely? Well, that's enough of that. You all have your amends to make with the world, and so do I. That's the Lord's way. I heard from Sassafras that she hitchhiked all the way across country when she told me she was going to drive away. That child is a mess. I'm up at night worrying about her wanton ways. But she's finally in Los Angeles and settling down a bit, I hope. I keep looking for Cypress's face to be on the news when they talk about those youngsters who've lost their minds in California. I swear I feel in my soul that she's wandering around San Francisco all painted up with stars and peace symbols. I pray the TV cameras never find her. She might do a dance. Then what would I say to all my neighbors? I got a painted dancing daughter in Haight-Ashbury. Smile. You are such a comfort to me. You've always been so serious and thoughtful. I want you to keep your head on your shoulders and try not to be so hard on your sisters. They aren't frivolous. They're just a bit wild. If you don't mind my saying, you're entitled to more fun than you allow yourself. Aunt Haiti's never been one for entertaining. If she gets a nap between all those women out there having babies every time you turn your back, it's a miracle. Now that I'm thinking about it, you might enjoy having a baby of your own more than delivering anybody else's. That does not mean for you to take up with one of those island boys either. I am concentrating on a nice young man here in Charleston. You know, you really should have been a doctor. No sense in being a nurse with all the experience you've had by now. The Lord will set you upon a path of decent pleasure, sure as he makes a way for honest toil. Saints be praised, Indigo, I've got to run. The strawberries are boiling over. I do love all of you all so much. Rushing away now. Love, Mama.
You've created a mother who wants her daughters to have nice middle-class lives, yeah. settle down with a nice husband, some children. When Cypress joins a radical black performance right. group, her mother mm-hmm. thinks, oh, terrific, a Negro mm-hmm. dance ensemble. She'd be wearing tutus. How wonderful.
Right, right.
But she accepts them, really, mm-hmm. no matter what they do. I wonder if you feel more like the mother or the daughter in the world now since you've recently become a mother.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the interesting things about having a baby. It's being between two worlds because my mother is still functioning. I am still a daughter, and I'm still this mother of this other person who is the daughter. And it's just getting bigger and bigger and much more complicated than I ever imagined it would be in terms of interrelationships because I had to figure out what grandmothers did. I had no idea. I mean, I knew as a child what my grandmother did for me. I had no idea what the other part of the triangle, who was my mother, did between the two of us. It's very strange. I haven't gotten nearly a clue to all the kinds of emotional things that are going on about that. It's very strange. My daughter calls me mommy and my mother mama. So it's very weird. And but I enjoy my child very much. I like us when we're by ourselves. I like it when we're with my mother. I don't yet quite like having the baby with my mother all the time, though, because you lose some of your intimate gestural relationship to your child when they're around somebody else who to whom they're also very close. I know their world is getting bigger, but it's just like you lose a little bit and the child gets bigger. So I'm learning already what mothers have to learn when their children go to school, that you have to let go of some things because you can't keep this baby with you all the time. And we're just getting to that stage now. Where she has relationships of her own with people now, which is very startling to me because she only had one with me for months and months and months.
The youngest daughter in your book is Indigo, and she's the most radical in a way, involved with magic and potions and intuition, and you made her more radical because her two older sisters are adventurers. And I was wondering in real life if she maybe would have been a business major. Because I found sometimes in real life that the youngest person in a family that's ended up mm-hmm. pretty radical starts being really conservative again and starting that cycle.
I don't know. She was also longer in the South than all the rest of them. She's the only one who has not been North. And I think that I was getting at, in a way, part of me was addressing what dislocation and migration do to the race in terms of changing your priorities.
Do you think there's some new kinds of families being formed now, like the one you're creating, for instance?
I guess you could call them new families. Although if you deal with the patriarchal father who was emotionally not present, in a way, mother-child relationships are essentially the same. It's the mother who's changing, but I think in truly patriarchal households, the father had so little emotional relationship to the children that his absence, in a way, is easier, to deal with. Encouraged by people adopting more children. I think that's single fathers particularly and single women too, because I think that those of us who have the means and desire to care for a child who is alone are doing a courageous and lovely thing to take a child who's already here as opposed to making one and then leaving the child who wasn't with anybody, still not with anybody. So in a way, yeah, I guess. But I think the more dramatic thing is that women are demanding changes in the old family and in the new family because we cannot do what Hilda Efania does. We cannot afford to stay in the house and make jam all day and or figure out how to cook 17 different kind of things by Sunday because we are working mothers. And so we are demanding of our partners, whoever they are, more involvement with the running of the household and with the development of the children. That, I think, is the most significant development.
Has your baby been an inspiration and also a drain as a writer?
As a writer, I can't say as a writer that it's an inspiration. No. As a visual artist, yes. I did a whole piece last year. I did a big installation piece called Savannah Land. That was a mythological geography for the baby. So one side of it was fetal, and inside a womb that was filled up with okra and garlic and peppers and things that we eat and magnolias and beautiful lace and stuff. All the things I did when I was pregnant. And on the other side was savanna in miniature of cotton fields and with two pickaninny dolls in the cotton fields with chains around them and a chandelier of hanging nooses over a perfectly set southern table and little half-dead black babies all around. And on the womb side, of course, there were full, healthy, multicolored black babies who were actually taken. I made them from a stencil of a photograph I had taken of my daughter in the tub, so that they literally were her 10 times bigger. Visually, it's stimulating to me. It's stimulating to me in nonverbal art forms. I think I'm very afraid to talk about my daughter in my work because I don't want to do that. So it comes out for me visually. I don't like the idea of somebody else's life. She is now living her life. I don't want her life to pull things from it. I want her to pull from her life. And I can celebrate it and help her guide it with it, but I don't want to use it. You see what I mean?
Yeah, you don't want to give her a kind of shadow life that would somehow determine what hers is going to be. Do you have an image of like what the perfect daughter grows into?
The perfect daughter?
Like your ideal daughter, or are you trying not to have an image?
I'm trying not to have one. I can't imagine. I can say what I ideally would like to make sure she has emotionally for herself, but what she does with it is I don't know. I want to make sure that she knows how to focus herself and that she knows that she has a right to make decisions about her life that are nourishing for her and that she has a resilience when she fails at something to realize that she failed at something that she is not, in fact, a failure. That to me would be a relative perfect, as long as she has the emotional tools you need to stay alive without injuring herself, I think that would be perfect for me.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. I'm speaking with Enzazaki Shange. And her new novel, her first novel, is called Sassafras, Cypress, and Indigo. It's just been published by the St. Martin's Press. I know a lot of listeners want to know what you thought of the public television production of For Colored Girls. And our listeners who saw it saw you introduce the production also with the aforementioned Savannah. the TV production was very different from the stage production. The stage production is just the women.
Right.
Basically reciting their person's poems, whereas the TV production had little dramatizations and the other people were actually there.
Right.
If a scene was supposed to take place in a nightclub, it was literally
in a
nightclub.
Right.
Yeah. Were you happy with that?
For the most part, yes. Yeah. I said it was like 85-15, and sometimes if I'm in a bad mood, I'd say 70-30. But I didn't want to do the stage version again because I had already done it, and I get bored very quickly, so I had to do something else. I realized that television is such a literal medium that I could not have seven women in different colored dresses talking to somebody you couldn't see in front of a flower for an hour and a half. It would have been disaster. So we had to put them somewhere, and I looked at the poems and I said, every poem in here says where they are. There's not one poem in here that does not say where they are, what they were doing. And so that's what I did. I just followed the text. It was what we call in theater, it's like you can do anything if you can support it in the text. So I just moved it to television and I said, I can do this because it's supported in the text. She said she went to the Corso. She said she went to Slugs. She said she was walking down the street. You know, so she said she went to a carnival. That's there. They said that's where they were. And the nice thing about the TV was that we could see it. And so it wouldn't be open to everybody's imagination. It gave me a little bit more what I liked. You know, it gave me my landscapes back.
For Color Girls has always been very controversial, and I think a lot of men have been really offended By what kind of reactions do you get to it now?
Well, I don't allow people to talk to me very much about it. I mean, I told one person one time who's trying to be nasty to me that I didn't talk to people who didn't like me and my work. I had no reason to be around people who were unfriendly, and I don't. So I don't get a lot of response. I assume that they're still talking to each other. I don't know. But I don't really worry about that because I really do understand that the struggle for the full the actualization of women's humanity, meaning our rights and capacities, is in fact a struggle. It is not it is not something that's going to be easily won. It has to do with undoing 10,000 years of misogyny. It is embedded in people's unconscious. It is in the unconscious where the most violence resides. I assume that because I am, in fact, battering down the doors of the patriarchy, that there will be some people who will be equally ready to batter us back.
Do you see black and white feminists working together or separately in the present and in the near future?
I work with feminists, period. I work particularly with women of color, but I don't know that we haven't been working together. I know we haven't been working enough. That's why ERA didn't pass, and that's why they're going to pass this insane anti-abortion legislation in the Congress, because we're not working enough. I don't know if it has anything to do with whether we're working with white people or with black people. I think the fact is that women are not doing enough to preserve the few rights we have. I think that if we can't get beyond who's black and who's white, then we'll all be dying with coat hangers somewhere. And that, to me, is a much more dangerous situation.
Do you think that you feel more like any of the characters in your book?
No.
I think there's a little bit of you in probably all of them.
Well, I think writing prose is like painting a portrait, and you're attracted to certain as a person designing this person. I was attracted to certain elements of them more than others, but I wanted to still give them full definition. So I would linger in the places that I found most amusing, and I would dash off the ones that I thought had to be done but that weren't terribly important. So, yeah, there's a little bit in everything. But I truly believe that I relate to them more as people that I know, as the characters. They are more my friends and contemporaries than they are me. In the poetry, I am continually confronted with me. The novel gave me an opportunity to make some new friends.
Are you writing another novel?
Not right this minute. I just finished a long stint of working on two plays, and I'm very, very tired. So I'm going to give my verbal activity a rest, and I'm going to do some more visual work this winter.
Have you been reading anything recently?
Mm-hmm.
Who have you been enjoying reading?
Oh, I just finished this wonderful novel from Brazil. It's just in translation now, called A Girl in a Photograph by Ligia Fagundes Telles. And what was so tickled me so much is that she didn't have three sisters, but she had three best friends who went to the same Catholic boarding. They lived in the same Catholic boarding house. One was a model, one was a drug addict, one was a revolutionary, and one was a very wealthy virginal person. So it was really delightful to me, because not only was it about people of color and about Latins, but it was also about three women whose lives were absolutely intertwined. So I felt very at home with them. And the other, what else did I just read? I'm reading 13th Valley, and I just got, that's not true. I just got a new something. What did I just get? Oh, I got Miguel Asturias's new book that I've been looking for. It's not new. It's a novel of his that I have been trying to find, and I couldn't find it until recently, called La Mulata. So I'm reading that right now.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for joining us and for talking with us about your work and some of the things you've been doing. Good luck with your future plays and such. Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And Sasaki Shange has been my guest, and her new novel is called Sassafras, Cypress, and Indigo. Her best-known work is probably for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. She has a volume of poems called Nappy Edges and a couple of plays in the work and several other plays that have also been produced. Her new novel is published by the St. Martin's Press. It's 3 minutes to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. First, let me tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. At 4 o'clock, we're going to rebroadcast an interview with Meg Bogan, who's the author of a book called The Path to Pain Control. She's going to talk about coping with chronic pain. And at 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by Robert Weiss, the new artistic director of the Pennsylvania Ballet. At 3:30, Frances Davis will be with us for Interval, this week's review of new jazz recordings. So I hope you can join us tomorrow afternoon. Ken Tucker contributed to today's show. Joyce Lieberman was the technical director. Maeve McGoran was the production assistant. And Danny Miller, the associate producer of the show. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening. And I wish you a very good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered, coming up live from Washington, D.C.
Support for this program comes from the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for Midwestern coverage, the Joyce Foundation, the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues, and RKO General, a radio and television broadcasting company. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
That still lives on Earth. We are Filipino. We got to support him, right? And that's the reason why we're enthusiastic to see him.
That's also one way of saying to our president that we love our country and also we love him very much.
And he's welcome to the United States.
Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos arrived in Washington today on an official visit. The official welcomes were cordial, but the man is controversial. Tonight on All Things Considered, the U.S., the Philippines, and the ties that bind.
And these stories, Israeli troops move into West Beirut after yesterday's assassination of Lebanon's president-elect.
Israel says its troops are there to prevent violence.
The U.S. asks all foreign powers to leave Lebanon.
Another report on termite control.
How safe are the chemicals used to curb the insects?
An incipient opera star Eduardo Villa talks and sings for us.
Novelist John Gardner is dead. A former colleague remembers the writer, the quick pace.